Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is June 18th, 2003. Today's session is Gilman and Chopin, Session 3 of Short Stories, Healing Body and Soul, presented by David Wee, WED 2003-03. Let's listen in.
My name is David Wee. I teach English at St. Olaf College. And this is the third day in this week's series of short stories on healing body and soul within the larger summer theme of healing the world. Our first 2 days, for those of you who were not here before, were stories by Flannery O'Connor, in which some startling and shocking things happened, and some of which were healing and some of which were not. Today I've picked two famous stories by two more women, Kate Chopin's The Story of an Hour and Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper. These are well-known stories. They have been very important stories for women particularly, but men also over the years as we try to understand each other and the circumstances in which we have put each other. Both of these stories have to do, at least in part, with illness. They're stories that are pretty tough on physicians. I know we have at least one in the room, maybe more.
I deserve it.
Partly because... Partly because both of these stories are hard on men. Time these were written 100 years ago, almost all physicians were males. As Flannery O'Connor reported to us in a line that we looked at last time, when somebody says asks her to explain what a story means, she says the only appropriate answer is read the story. And fortunately, the first story today is short enough, just 2 pages long, so we can have the luxury of hearing the whole story read, and then we'll have time to discuss it. We'll probably spend a little bit less time on the yellow wallpaper, and we won't read it all, but we'll read some excerpt from it so you get the flavor of that story and the author's voice. I've asked Anne to read The Story of an Hour. Again, it only takes a few minutes, and the action all takes place within 1 hour's time. And I'd like you to pay special attention to the language that the author uses in describing the way in which Mrs. Mallard responds to the news of her husband's death. Listen very carefully to the care with which she describes Mrs. Mallard's response. And then listen carefully for the images, the imagery of the story, the location, and what sounds and sights appear in the story. Anne, could you go ahead and start? We'll talk about anything you wish after you've heard it.
Story of an Hour. Knowing that Mrs. Mallard was afflicted with a heart trouble, great care was taken to break to her as gently as possible the news of her husband's death. It was her sister Josephine who told her in broken sentences, veiled hints that revealed in half concealing. Her husband's friend Richards was there too, near her. It was he who had been in the newspaper office when intelligence of the railroad disaster was received, with Bentley Mallard's name leading the list of killed. He had only taken the time to assure himself of its truth by a second telegram, and had hastened to forestall any less careful, less tender friend in bearing the sad message. She did not hear the story as many women have heard the same, with a paralyzed inability to accept its significance. She wept at once, with sudden wild abandonment, aunt in her sister's arms. When the storm of grief had spent itself, she went away to her room alone. She would have no one follow her. There stood, facing the open window, a comfortable, roomy armchair. Into this she sank, pressed down by a physical exhaustion that haunted her body and seemed to reach into her soul. She could see in the open square before her house the tops of trees that were all aquiver with the new spring life. The delicious breath of rain was in the air. In the street below, a peddler was crying his wares. The notes of a distant song, which someone was singing, reached her faintly, and countless sparrows were twittering in the eaves. There were patches of blue sky showing here and there through the clouds that had met and piled one above the other in the west facing the window. She sat with her head thrown back upon the cushion of the chair, quite motionless, except when a sob came up into her throat and shook her, as a child who has cried itself to sleep continues to sob in its dreams. She was young, with a fair, calm face, whose lines bespoke repression and even a certain strength. But now there was a dull stare in her eyes, whose gaze was fixed away off yonder on one of those patches of blue sky. It was not a glance of reflection, but rather indicated a suspension of intelligent thought. There was something coming to her, and she was waiting for it fearfully. What was it? She did not know. It was too subtle and elusive to name. But she felt it creeping out of the sky, reaching toward her through the sounds, the scents, the color that filled the air. Now her bosom rose and fell tumultuously. She was beginning to recognize the thing that was approaching to possess her, and she was striving to beat it back with her will, as powerless as her two white, slender hands would have been. When she abandoned herself, a little whispered word escaped her slightly parted lips. She said it over and over under her breath. Free, free, free. The vacant stare and the look of terror that had followed it went from her eyes. They stayed keen and bright. Her pulses beat fast, and the coursing blood warmed and relaxed every inch of her body. She did not stop to ask if it were or were not a monstrous joy that held her. A clear and exalted perception enabled her to dismiss the suggestion as trivial. She knew that she would weep again when she saw the kind, tender hands folded in death, the face that had never looked save with love upon her, fixed and gray and dead. But she saw beyond that bitter moment a long procession of years to come that would belong to her absolutely. And she opened and spread her arms out to them in welcome. There would be no one to live for her during those coming years. She would live for herself. There would be no powerful will bending hers in that blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon a fellow creature. A kind intention or a cruel intention made the act seem no less a crime as she looked upon it in that brief moment of illumination. And yet she had loved him, sometimes. Often she had not. What did it matter? What could love, the unsolved mystery, count for in the face of this possession of self-assertion, which she suddenly recognized as the strongest impulse of her being? Free, body and soul, free, she kept whispering. Josephine was kneeling before the closed door with her lips to the keyhole, imploring for admission. Louise, open the door, I beg you, open the door. You will make yourself ill. What are you doing, Louise? For heaven's sakes, open the door. Go away. I am not making myself ill. No, she was drinking in a very elixir of life through that open window. Her fancy was running riot along those days ahead of her. spring days and summer days and all sorts of days that would be her own. She breathed a quick prayer that life might be long. It was only yesterday she had thought with a shudder that life might be long. She arose at length and opened the door to her sister's importunities. There was a feverish triumph in her eyes, and she carried herself unwittingly like a goddess of victory. She clasped her sister's waist, and together they descended the stairs. Richard stood waiting for them at the bottom. Someone was opening the front door with a latch key. It was Bentley Mallard who entered, a little travel-stained, composedly carrying his grip sack and umbrella. He had been far from the scene of accident and did not even know there had been one. He stood amazed at Josephine's piercing cry, at Richard's quick motion to screen him from the view of his wife. But Richard's was too late. When the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease, of joy that kills.
This is a kind of shocker, isn't it? we're forewarned in the very first sentence that she has heart trouble. So we know that there's an illness or a difficulty at least. So Chopin has prepared us for this in ways we didn't expect. But here she has learned that her husband has died, and she goes through an hour of various responses, emerges from her room, comes downstairs, discovered that her husband is alive. And what does kill her? Is it the joy that kills? Disappointment?
Or shock?
Shock. Mm-hmm. And what has happened to her through the two brief pages of this story?
She got freedom.
She realized she was free. Mm-hmm. And free from what?
Control.
Control.
Any control.
Okay. Yeah.
Someone else's expectations.
Someone else's expectations. Okay.
The responsibility of caring.
Okay, the responsibility of caring.
Mm-hmm. She did love him at times, she said.
Yeah.
And he loved her.
He loved her. You know, it's not that she was married to a wife beater. You know, there was not domestic abuse involved here. This was a good couple. You know, they loved each other. They were good to each other. She had only experienced kindness from him. But when she realizes that he's gone, she moves from yesterday, when she was afraid that life might be long, to today, when she prays that life would be long. Suddenly the future ahead of her is totally different from what it was going to be with her kindly, loving Brentley Mallard. Did you notice the way in which Kate Chopin carefully describes how she came to this? Is she willfully searching for this freedom? Does she seek it out? her mind has sort of gone blank after she's had her initial grief, and she is sitting there without kind of much thought process. And she begins to sense this coming through the window.
Looking at the blue sky beyond.
What does she see and hear through that window?
Music.
Birds
singing.
Birds singing. New life, new growth, springtime. And with it comes something that she cannot beat back. You know, even if she had the power to beat back this sense that I am free at last. She can't do it. So it's not that she is a person who is saying, yes, he's gone, you know, I'm free at last. It's a sensation that has come to her through that open window, unbidden, unexpected, really not gratefully received, but it happens. And by the end of the hour, instead of being on her knees or on the bed weeping, she's carrying herself like a goddess of victory. And she goes downstairs with her sister, and there's Brentley coming in the door alive. And she dies not of the joy that she has, but of the shock that this new life that she had just begun has been snatched away from her. How do you respond to that? I mean, this is not the way people usually respond to a death and then sudden relief from that awfulness. When I teach this with college students, they're furious at her. You know, they get really mad. You know, they are falling in love with people and expecting that from here on in, you know, it's going to be perfect love forever. And, you know, it's what we all hope when we're young and in love and picking our partner. But here's a situation where we discover that something has happened to her and to their relationship.
How old was the author when she wrote this?
She was about 45, I think.
What year was it?
This was published in 1894. So it is a little over 100 years ago. It was shocking to the reading public, and she was not well received. And when this, and then later her novel, The Awakening, which takes this whole theme further, she was just ostracized by much of the public because this was not the way we're supposed to think about marriage relationships. A couple of sentences in here just to refresh your mind on them. Key couple sentences perhaps are where she realizes that there would be no powerful will bending hers in that blind persistence with which men and women believe they have a right to impose a private will upon a fellow creature. She's not saying this is only a male characteristic, but that, you know, we want to impose our will on a partner or on someone else. And then here's a key sentence. A kind intention or a cruel intention made the act seem no less a crime. So she defines, or Mrs. Mallard in her situation here is thinking of kindly Brentley's imposing of his will on hers, which was the usual thing in a patriarchal society and a very common thing even today, as a crime. And it doesn't matter whether the other party is cruel or kindly, it's still a crime. Very important language here, and language that you can imagine rattled the minds of many readers.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that she used the word creature too, rather than man or woman.
Yeah.
You know, it's the vulnerability of anything alive that has to be subject to another's way of doing it.
Yeah.
And the time this is written in is more controlling. You know, the society they lived in was far more controlled than what we have now.
That's right. And a woman was expected to be a support to her husband, do whatever the husband asked or demanded in order that the career might be carried forward and so the children could be raised and the husband could be free to pursue a career. So yeah, this is well before two career families, which have become fairly common for us now. But probably all of us, when we're honest, imagine our relationships with our partner, recognize that there have been many moments when we either wanted to or actually did try to impose our own will on the other, on the partner. I constantly think of starts way back when. And when, you know, if in junior high, two of you are dating and the one you're dating even speaks to a rival, you don't want to allow your beloved to even talk to somebody else. You know, it's a threat. We try to impose our will way back then. And we become very skilled at this, and sometimes very subtle and very kindly, as obviously Martin Mallard was. And probably blind to the fact that we are doing it. And what Kate Chopin does here is to show us what a huge impact it is to suddenly discover that you're free of that seemingly benign relationship where a partner is imposing a will. And finally, you can look forward to a future of new growth and life and song and music, and then have it snatched away like that when she discovered her husband is still living. I hope you noticed the where is she when all of this takes place? Where does most of this story take place? Yep, in a room with the door locked but the window open, and she's looking out the window. Women writers for decades began to use confinement imagery in their stories and poetry to try to make the point of how trapped they were in their lives. And then this is one classic example of it. She has been trapped and caged and caught in this relationship, pleasant as it seemed to be to most people. And when the change is happening, there she is in this little room in the house, but the window is open, and bringing in signs of a different and fuller life. And within an hour, she's been transformed into somebody who says, there's a different life awaiting for me, and now I hope my life will be long. And ironically, her life lasts a few more minutes. Yeah.
Well, whenever you love and care for someone, it limits your freedom because you're thinking of their welfare.
Yeah.
Whether it would be a caregiver for someone who's ill or a husband or wife. There's just this constant compromise of interests and time.
That's right. And most of us have chosen to make compromises, you know, to not live in a totally self-willful way. But it's
hard to be even.
It is hard to be even, yeah. Probably. That's right. Are any of you who are really disturbed or bothered by this? Because it is, you know, it's hard for couples and widows and widowers to read this and say, how could she be like that? Yes.
Well, I am a widow, and I don't know that I'm disturbed by the way the story was constructed, but what I find unrealistic is the ability to actually grapple with your spouse's death that quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, initially, it isn't just that you cry, you go in absolute shock.
Yeah.
And you could not cross it, even if she lived 100 years before I did and was in a more oppressive relationship, more patriarchal society, and longed to be free more than I did. You know, putting all those things aside, I don't think she could have processed that psychologically.
Yeah.
And I'm not a psychologist. I mean,
yeah.
I just have walked that street. And I just don't find it realistic.
Yeah, okay.
That's, and it isn't being offended by it, it's just...
Yeah, that it seems to be too quick. And
too quick.
Yeah.
I'm standing because it's hard for me to sit. It's also a story, I think, not just about her and her grief, but about all of us who are so willing to give up freedoms, and not just for love, but for the fact that we do that for love too. But we also do it because we really don't like perfect, absolute kind of freedom. I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. And I think it's shocking to us, at least it is to me as a reader, to realize, wow, I'm pretty eager to give up my freedom. I'm thinking of another story where a guy in the line is, make us your slaves, but feed us. I'm willing to surrender. Tell me what to do, how to behave, when, and we do that as a culture, you know, make laws for this and that. So I wonder if it isn't also about all of us, not just about her and her grief.
Yeah. Okay. Their relationship is a metaphor for all sorts of other kinds of social situations.
I don't want to detract from the discussion, but there was I just read the story this afternoon, and there was a couple things that just didn't quite fit here. The fact that her husband's friend Richard called twice or telegraphed twice to make sure that in fact he was dead. And he's also there when she comes down the stairs and tries to step between them, and almost made me wonder, maybe I just have a criminal mind, and all of a sudden you wonder whether she was being set up. And whether, I mean, and then he had to unlock the door. Why was the door locked? And why hadn't he heard about this? The first time I read it, I thought, man, maybe Richard and her husband wanted to knock her off.
You do have a criminal mind.
You learn these things at Luther College.
Well, for a story like this to work this well and to be this short, and this is true about short stories. A writer doesn't have time to write a 300-page novel where characters could be developed and circumstances could prepare us for something else. A short story writer picks some small slice, in this case an hour of time, and more bizarre things have happened than that a mistaken death has been reported. And Chopin is trying to make the surprise all the stronger by saying that Richard's checked on it twice, just to make sure. You would hope a friend might do that. Why the news was wrong in 1894, communications weren't quite as accurate, and we still make mistakes like this, you know, misidentifying people. But sure, there are a couple of elements here, like the quickness of all this happening. You might expect that maybe over 3 months' time that a bereaved spouse might begin to see glimmers of a different life. But here's a story in which at least it starts for one woman very quickly.
And yet she dealt with her husband's grief for death for an hour. But then when he came back, she instantaneously died. So
yeah.
That seems, I mean, she did work on it for an hour and then realized that as she was being pulled back to the life that she thought that she was now kind of rid of, she instantaneously died.
Yeah.
So the grief and shock of that was really fast.
Yeah. And of course, the doctor's misdiagnosis at the end is there in part to emphasize the fact that this is an unconventional thing. We wouldn't expect this to happen. And what would you assume would have caused her death? You'd think that she would have been overjoyed to see her husband. But the story has prepared us for the fact that something hugely important has been snatched away from her. And she didn't even realize, apparently, that she was missing this sense of freedom. But we learn in two pages that she discovers that she was missing it.
You know, I think it's possible at a time of a death to have perfect clarity for a moment. I mean, people grieve in all different ways. And she allowed herself a thought that she probably would never have had ever in her life.
Yeah.
And my sense of her death was that she couldn't go back. You know, she had this thought, which probably was unacceptable to her,
mm-hmm.
with the husband returning.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I heard it.
And clearly she didn't seek out this freedom, you know. She didn't say, oh, at last I'm free. It just was it came to her unbidden.
And it's unacceptable to everybody else, too. So they have to make that the reason that she died.
Yeah.
You know, it couldn't be that, oh my gosh, I'm shocked back into this marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing implied in what Jeannie was saying, though, is that the space of an hour had two big shocks. The
mm-hmm.
first one and
yes.
the second, and they're totally opposite. And they
yeah.
come really close together.
Yeah.
And so...
And that
physically,
yeah.
I mean, just let alone not thinking about what is going on emotionally,
yeah.
But the physical phenomenon would be quite something.
So for a person with a weak heart,
mm-hmm.
you know, having these two jarring things happening so close together.
I can't remember what it says right at the end, but I mean, I'd kind of like to argue the fact that maybe it isn't that she doesn't want him to come in the door. It's just simply shock.
Well, we see in the last couple paragraphs, we read almost nothing about her. We read that Richards was down there,
mm-hmm.
someone was coming in the door,
she's
Josephine,
sister.
The sister, screams. Richards tries to block the view to kind of dampen the shock. We aren't even told that she died. Until the last sentence, you know, Richards was too late. That's the hint that she has died. And then the last sentence, when the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease. So the focus is really on everyone trying to protect her there at the end. And then the diagnosis, which we as readers know was dead wrong, but it would be a logical assumption to make that by a doctor or anyone else.
It's interesting that there's when you're a coronary artery disease, which is what she probably had, you can induce a heart attack. If she's having angina, you can induce a heart attack by exercising things. You can also induce one by anything that induces the outpouring of adrenaline. And in anger, sudden emotions can do it. About the time that story was written, in about 1900, a famous American physician had angina, and he wrote that the first man who makes me mad can kill me.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people that had, before the days of nitroglycerin and stuff, would die if somebody made him mad or if
yeah.
he had a sudden prolonged emotion. So this also the idea that she died in those circumstances medically, this isn't far-fetched at all.
Yeah.
And how appropriate that it's heart disease. I mean, you
yeah.
know, how symbolic of that.
Yeah. That's right.
It wasn't a stroke, it wasn't it.
It was her heart, and that was where the problem was, that's right.
The other thing about her quick reaction, I think one thing that Chopin does that kind of maybe makes that possible is when it talks that just yesterday she had been thinking how she hoped her life wouldn't be long. So at some level, she was really struggling with
yeah.
what her life was like.
Yeah.
Yeah. So probably that had something to do with the quickness of the reaction, that it was right there.
Yeah.
read the last sentence again.
Okay.
Do it, please.
When the doctors came, they said she had died of heart disease, of joy that kills.
It struck me, I didn't know why, and I'm not sure I know why still, but one, it's doctors, and it's this is the only acceptable thing.
Yeah.
That she, I mean, she can't die from anything else.
Yeah.
That fits the... This is the way a woman's supposed to live.
Yeah. And if we had not been privy to what was going on in that room, any of us might have assumed the same thing.
Yeah.
That the doctors did.
And because maybe she didn't even know the extent of her unhappiness. Even though she said yesterday life was going to be really long, I mean, maybe you just don't want to admit how unhappy you really are. So of course they would think that because she had perhaps never spoken about the reality of where... of how she really felt in
this situation. Yeah, good. Well, we've got about 20 minutes left, so let's take a start with the other story, which has some similarities. And it's about this one called The Yellow Wallpaper. It is about a woman and her physician husband who have taken for the summer a... lodgings in a kind of large Gothic country house, and she is suffering from some unnamed malady, it's actually named as hysteria in here, which we'll talk about in a minute. The whole story is journal entries by the woman. She is writing in a journal. She is a writer, and one of the problems is that her husband says, if you want to be cured, you mustn't write. Takes away her true greatest joy from her, because it's part of the cure. Charlotte Perkins Gilman had undergone treatment by a famous American physician named S. Weir Mitchell in Philadelphia, I believe, who is nationally famous for having cure for the kind of depression that women like the narrator here has suffered. Karen, you're a writer. Would you read the first sort of two pages here? We'll get most of the key details in here about the setting, about the circumstances, and then I'll direct us to a few other passages and report what happens at the end. And, you know, some of you may wish to go and read the whole story. These stories, by the way, there's about 6 copies of every story for this week on reserve in books like this or that one in the library.
The Yellow Wallpaper. It is very seldom that mere ordinary people like John and myself secure ancestral halls for the summer. A colonial mansion, a hereditary estate, I would say a haunted house and reach the height of romantic felicity, but that would be asking too much of fate. Still, I will proudly declare that there's something queer about it, else why should it be let so cheaply? And why have stood so long untenanted? John laughs at me, of course, but one expects that. John is practical in the extreme. He has no patience with faith and the intense horror of superstition. And he scoffs openly at any talk of things not to be felt and seen and put down in figures. John's a physician, and perhaps, I would not say it to a living soul, of course, but this is dead paper and great relief to my mind. Perhaps that is one reason I do not get well faster. You see, he doesn't believe I am sick, and what can one do? If a physician of high standing, one's own husband, assures friends and relatives that there's really nothing the matter with one but temporary nervous depression, a slight hysterical tendency, what is one to do? My brother is also a physician, also of high standing, and he says the same thing. So I take phosphates, or phosphites, whichever it is, and tonics, and air, and exercise, and journeys, and am absolutely forbidden to work until I am well again. Personally, I disagree with their ideas. Personally, I believe that congenial work, with excitement and change, would do me good. But what is one to do? I did write for a while in spite of them, but it does exhaust me a good deal, having to be so sly about it. or else meet with heavy opposition. I sometimes fancy that in my condition, if I had less opposition and more society and stimulus, but John says that's the very worst thing I can do, to think more about my condition, and I confess it makes me feel bad. So I will let it alone and talk about the house. The most beautiful place. It's quite alone, standing well back from the road, quite 3 miles from the village. It makes me think of English places that you read about, for there are hedges and walls and gates that lock, and lots of separate little houses for the gardeners and people. There is a delicious garden. I never saw such a garden, large and shady, full of box bordering paths and lined with long grape-covered arbors with seats under them. There were greenhouses, but they were all broken now. There was some legal trouble, I believe, something about the heirs and the co-heirs. Anyway, the place has been empty for years. That spoils my ghostliness, I'm afraid, but I don't care. There's something strange about the house. I can feel it. I even said so to John one moonlight evening, but he said what I felt was a draft, and he shut the window. I get unreasonably angry with John sometimes. I'm sure I never used to be so sensitive. I think it's due to this nervous condition. But John says if I feel so, I shall neglect proper self-control. So I take pains to control myself, before him at least, and that makes me very tired. I don't like our room a bit. I wanted one downstairs that opened onto the piazza and had roses all over the window and such pretty old-fashioned chintz hangings, but John wouldn't hear of it. He said there was only one window and not room for two beds, and no near room for him if he took another. He is very careful and loving and hardly lets me stir without special direction. I have a scheduled prescription for each hour in the day. He takes all care from me, and so I feel basely ungrateful not to value it more. He said he came here solely on my account, that I was to have perfect rest and all the air I could get. Quote, "Your exercise depends on your strength, my dear," said he, "and your food somewhat on your appetite, but air you can absorb all the time." So we took the nursery at the top of the house. It's a big airy room, the whole floor nearby, with windows that look all ways, and air and sunshine galore. It was a nursery first, and then a playroom and a gymnasium, I should judge, for the windows are barred for little children. And there are rings and things in the walls. The paint and paper look as if a boys' school had used it. It is stripped off the paper in great patches all around the head of my bed, about as far as I can reach. And in a great place on the other side of the room, low down, I never saw a worse paper in my life, one of those sprawling flamboyant patterns committing every artistic sin. It is dull enough to confuse the eye and following pronounced enough constantly to irritate and provoke study, and when you follow the lame, uncertain curves for a little distance, they suddenly commit suicide, plunge off at outrageous angles, destroy themselves in unheard of contradictions. The color is repellent, almost revolting, a smoldering, unclean yellow, strangely faded by the slow-turning sunlight. It is a dull yet lurid orange in some places, a sickly sulfur tint in others. No wonder the children hated it. I should hate it myself if I had to live in this room long. There comes John. I must put this away. He hates to have me write a word.
Okay, thank you. Okay, you notice some similar themes operating here? Some similar kinds of details? Here she is, she's suffering some kind of nervous depression. It's been labeled hysteria. That was a term that was given to those undefinable women's problems.
He's causing it the way he treats her.
Yeah. He is wanting to control in a kind-hearted way, you know, for all he thinks are the right reasons, to control her actions. What she wants is excitement and life and the ability to write, and she has to hide the fact from him that she's writing at all. We learn soon after this that she's recently had a baby. When I was teaching this to a college class up here at Holden a few years ago, we had a retired nurse in the class. And I was asking the class what they thought was wrong with the main character. And she just got impatient and finally said, well, she's suffering from postpartum depression. And of course, hysteria, which has the same root as uterus and hysterectomy, was a term given to all sorts of women's problems. And many of them were given incorrect, unhelpful kinds of treatments like this. Removal, bed rest, no excitement, no visitors, not even writing in your own journal. So she has to sneak it. They choose to be in this upstairs bedroom in this house because it has windows going out in all directions. But notice there are bars on the windows. You know, talk about another cage image and prison-like imagery. Later we learn there's a gate at the head of the stairs. Was a nursery at one time, but now there's an adult woman in it, and she is going crazy from her inactivity and from this horrid wallpaper, which is described in more detail throughout the story. Some brilliant descriptions of ghastly wallpaper design. And the woman in the room, notice she said the wallpaper was torn off near the bedstead about as far as she could reach. She has been the one to tear the wallpaper off. She begins to see behind this weird wallpaper a woman crawling around, creeping through the patterns. We learn by the end of the story that she has been, as her mental faculties disintegrate, she has been crawling around on her hands and knees all around the room, and her shoulder has been wearing off the wallpaper at the same level all the way around. First she sees a woman in there, finally she realizes that it's herself, and she's been, as she goes crazier and crazier, is doing that. She starts tearing the wallpaper off as far up as she can reach. She starts gnawing on the bedstead, and first she thinks the children who lived here before must have done this, but we as readers gradually learn through her journal entries that she is the one who's been doing this. John and John's sister, who has come to help out with the baby, constantly visit her, and her husband, John, the physician, is constantly denying her request to please move me to another room, anything but this room. This passage ended with, I should hate this wallpaper if I had to live here long. She asks to be removed to one of the other rooms in the house. He says, oh no, the others aren't as good. She said, let's go home. He said, oh, we've got 3 weeks left on the rent. We certainly can't leave when we've paid for the rent in advance. And besides the repairs at home, apparently they're having renovations, which is one reason they came here, they aren't done yet. We can't move in. I'm not done with my business here. Thinks up all the kind of economic and rational reasons why they shouldn't leave this place that is driving her crazy.
It's funny because this is more horrible, but the image that keeps coming to my mind is the fairy tale that we read to our kids, Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair. And the tower where you can't get down. I mean, if you're in the room on the ground floor, in some ways you're safer because, or you can get out.
Yeah.
You can reach the ground, and but if you're up, you fall or you die. And that I've often thought about the subtlety in our children being brought up on that fairy tale.
Yeah.
There's so much glamorous about it, but not really. Well, does she recover?
No.
Does she recover?
No.
Tragic ending.
John keeps coming in, and the language he uses toward her is condescending. Talks of her as a little child, my little goose. even engages in baby talk at some time. Bless her little heart, he's talking to her. Bless her little heart, said he with a big hug. She shall be as sick as she pleases. And I'm talking directly to her. So all the way through, we see the husband condescending to his wife and treating her as an infant, as a child. And he says to her, I am a doctor, dear, and I know. You are getting better. She says, no, I'm getting worse. He says, no, I'm a doctor. Can you not trust me as a physician when I tell you so? And she is experiencing the reality of her own mental and physical deterioration. But John says, I'm a doctor, so I'm right and you're wrong. Then he lays the guilt trip on her. You've got to do this for me. You've got to stay here and get better for me and for the baby. So constantly he's laying on her that responsibility that you owe it to me, you owe it to the baby to do exactly as I say and stay here and follow my treatment. And
what was the year of this short story?
This one was written in 1892, 2 years before Kate Chopin. Well, you ought to read the whole thing to get more images of this wallpaper. But and the fascinating way in which the author is able to show the gradual deterioration of her mental abilities, even though she's still writing coherently, you can see her losing control over everything. And you can see her beginning to recognize that she is the woman in the wallpaper. And finally, John comes up. She's locked the door to keep him out, just as Mrs. Mallard locked out Josephine. So she's up there in this locked room, and he pounds on the door, and he's going to go get an axe because he's worried about her. And she says, no, the key is under a plantain leaf down by the front door, and she says it over and over again, and finally he goes down and looks, and sure enough, the key is there. He comes in, and here's how the story ends. He came in, he stopped short by the door. What is the matter? He cried. For God's sake, what are you doing? I kept on creeping just the same, but I looked at him over my shoulder. So she's creeping along the edge of the wallpaper. I've got out at last, said I. She believes that she has gotten help from behind the wallpaper. In spite of you and Jane. And I've pulled off most of the paper, so you can't put me back. He's come in and found that she's ripped the wallpaper off as far as she can reach. She's crawling around like an animal at the base of the wall. And her last words are, now why should that man have fainted? But he did. And right across my path by the wall, so that I had to creep over him every time. So she goes around crawling right over his body every time she comes
around. We need to hear that.
Okay. She says, now why should that man have fainted? But he did. And right across my path by the wall, so that I had to creep over him every time. So the story ends with her having really lost her hand of reality, and her husband has fainted dead away seeing what's happened to her, and she just keeps going around and around the room, crawling right over his body. We don't know what happens, we don't know if she recovers, but by the end of the story, we see the damage that has been done. And she has physically and mentally deteriorated in the process of being healed, by the treatment that has been prescribed for her. And again, we have a woman in a cage image in a room, confined in an upstairs room. And all of it has served as a kind of metaphor for many, many women readers of how trapped women at that time have been in the lives they've led, and the kind of control of a patriarchal society. And I encourage all of us to think about how much of that is still going on in our own lives and in our own culture. But the meeting is about to happen, so we need to stop and open up for the staff meeting to happen in here. Thank you very much.